Hello, this is The Money. I'm Richard Ady. Today we take a look at the vast industry that you probably don't love, but use pretty much every week, perhaps even more. I took her to a supermarket. I don't know why, but I just started somewhere. So it started there. Supermarkets are such a quotidian part of life, we mostly don't think about them. But we should. Yesterday, Woolworths announced a profit of $1.5 billion. That's not all from the supermarkets, but it is the biggest player in the sector, and its food sales are up 4.5% over the last year. Michelle Levine, CEO of Roy Morgan Research, is a close observer of the sector.
Well, the supermarket sector is a pretty big market. It's worth over $90 billion, and it's a sector that's really dominated by two major players in Australia. But we're seeing Aldi, the third player, really cutting a swathe through the others. So we're seeing lots of activity going on in the supermarket sector. And I think the other thing is there's a lot of people quaking in their boots as they think about Amazon coming.
We'll get to Amazon later, but Michelle mentioned Aldi, which is having a huge effect.
It's kind of interesting when you hear about the notion of a Coles shopper or a Woolworths shopper or an Aldi shopper. You know, we all sort of shop around, and that's one of the key things is that the major supermarkets have got to try and keep customers getting all of their goods there because, yeah, Aldi has attracted lots of people. Wherever they've opened up their shops, they've managed to attract people to go there. They're not just people who are looking for bargains because they don't have very much income. It's a whole range of people that will shop at Aldi for particular purposes.
In the US, the supermarket is changing rapidly. Here's Phil Lempert, analyst and editor of supermarketguru.com.
In fact, that traditional supermarket, especially here in the U.S., that's about 40, 50,000 square foot, that's a dinosaur and it's extinct. What shoppers are looking for, as shoppers have become much more interested in food, and a lot of that has been led by the millennial generation, to be honest with you, they're looking for their retailer, their grocer, to take a much more active role. For example, they want them to curate offerings, not just buy everything they can and pile it high and put it on a shelf somewhere. They really want the retailer to be more involved and really understand what their needs are. So we're starting to see smaller stores, Aldi and Lidl, for example, from Europe, really taking hold here and growing. Amazon buying Whole Foods is going to change that whole dynamic. And every retailer is experimenting with putting restaurants, we call them grocerants here, within their store, more fresh foods, those unemotional boxes, jars, and cans, we're getting rid of those. We don't have to have 100 different bottles of olive oil that are basically all the same. What we want is we want a retailer to find us the best 8 or the best 10 that really have a point of difference, and that way we have a much better way to choose.
And here too, the emphasis is increasingly on the experience. Kate Brown is the lifestyle editor at Choice.
I've heard awful phrases like retail entertainment. Shopping centres will almost be like a museum. It will have things that you can touch and feel and look at. You may not necessarily buy them on the spot, but people are always going to want to congregate, touch, feel, taste. And we're seeing that reflected in supermarkets. We're seeing a lot of food demonstrations, tasting events, things like the sushi bars. You know, it's quite interactive. Another thing that I think is hilarious is Coles Radio is so popular that you can now pick it up on digital radio. And I've seen a number of people, including Lee Sales, put on social media that her favourite radio station is actually Coles Radio, which is very, very clever because it's all about building that brand and building that experience to come in store.
You're listening to Coles Radio.
Did you know that 80% of the world's supply of almonds comes from California?
One of the things you may have noticed in the supermarkets is that there's less choice than there used to be. The big two especially have cut the number of lines they hold and introduced more in-house or private label brands. This annoys consumers, but it makes financial sense.
They definitely have manufacturers under their thumb and they have a private label. They control the process from beginning to end. We know a lot of manufacturers at the time who were very scared to speak on the record, to be honest, said they were heavily pressured around price, production. They're often expected to bear the brunt of markdowns or sales in-house. So bringing things in-house means they do have that control over the brands. It means they can have less brands on the shelf and dominate that particular sector.
And Kate Brown says there's something else.
The other thing that's new and really interesting is what they call phantom brands. Now, if anyone's shopped at Aldi, they'd be familiar with phantom brands. They're called various things like Chocoeur chocolate in Aldi is Aldi, but it's not branded as Aldi. It's branded as its own brand. And we're starting to see the big two supermarkets do this as well. And the reason for doing this is there is a perception out there in the public that often private labels aren't as good. So phantom labels provide that kind of medium price point. So you might have a proprietary brand, a non-private label brand as the most expensive. You might have the private label, the in-house supermarket brand as the cheapest. The phantom brand will sit in the middle. And often when people are buying, we know from consumer psychology, they bracket. So they look at the cheapest and the most expensive and they'll go for the one in the middle. So phantom brands are a deliberate tactic to do that.
Supermarkets and brands like Arnott's or Uncle Toby's or Kraft are not friends. They need each other, but the relationship is changing. Michelle Levine.
This grocery market, like all markets that I can think of, is just becoming so fragmented. And, you know, I suppose it used to be that a brand, a Kraft or whatever the brand is, would actually be the dreamer-upper of the product. They'd dream up the product, they'd create the packaging, they'd create the brand, they would manufacture the goods. You know, they were in charge of it end to end. The fragmentation means now that brands are being licensed to other people, the manufacturing is being offshored or created elsewhere. All of the elements are being broken up. So I think the introduction of an Amazon or even the current retailers is really just taking advantage of that fragmentation. And they're saying, well, we're the most important ones. We are the ones that are going to be delivering to the consumer. And therefore, we are in charge of the consumer relationship, not you, the brand owner. And there's this really interesting battle for the consumer's heart and mind going on underneath the surface.
And in America, the battle seems to have been won.
What we've seen here in the U.S. is iconic brands that have been around for 100 years or so. Well, they're just falling by the wayside because, again, with a new generation, you know, they don't have that same feeling about Cheerios that their parents did or their grandparents did or their great-grandparents did. So as a result, that whole model is shifting. And to your point, at times, a lot of these store brands are made by manufacturers, but it's become such a huge business. There are companies now who are just doing store brands. They don't have their own brand.
Phil Lempert doesn't think big brands are finished. They're making acquisitions and trying to evolve quickly as consumer tastes change. But increasingly, we're looking for something extra. And that's what's on offer from Australian brand Thank You. Kate Carnell is the Australian Small Business and Family Enterprise Ombudsman.
They've been incredibly successful, and it shows that consumers are looking for something different. Because Thank You, I think they started with water, but they're now in a whole range of different areas, baby nappies, all sorts of things. They're a not-for-profit operation, so their profit, shall we say, or their surplus goes back to charity, back to communities. And consumers have embraced that. So it's interesting they are looking for things that are different, things where they can contribute back to the community, whether it be local manufacturers, Australian jobs, or in the case of Thank You, to charity.
On The Money Today, we're looking at supermarkets.
I want to say welcome to a wonderland, an amusement park full of delights, and the best part is they have one in every town. It's your local supermarket where you're at a cart around the...
Don't waste your life in the sauce aisle. Unlike other supermarkets, Aldi only stocks the best.
The biggest change in the last 10 years has been the increasing success of the German chain Aldi. It doesn't carry anything like the number of lines offered in Coles or Woolworths. Nearly every line it does offer is a phantom brand. But those brands are cheaper, and that's what pulls the customers in.
Aldi has been an amazing success story. Yes, it came onto the market, did extremely well with not that many stores. And then what it's done since then is introduced more and more stores, you know, clearly learning as they went. And I think they've done extremely well. And so they continue to open stores and they continue to take market share. The challenge for Aldi now is to actually keep their customers satisfied, because you know, when you're a niche player, we often find that the smaller players have got more satisfied customers. People kind of choose them and they feel like they're a special place just for them. And then as they grow, if they grow like Aldi's doing, it's hard to keep it new and fresh and exciting.
Aldi has been smart, focused and prepared to take things slowly. Kate Carnell.
It's interesting what patient capital will do, even in a market like Australia, which has always been a very difficult market for new players, new major supermarket chains to hit Australia. Many have tried. They've all failed until Aldi. And Aldi has taken this long-term view. They've ensured that their quality is good. They've embraced Australian made. They're a big user of the Australian made triangular kangaroo. They've ensured that good quality, local, but good price, and people have embraced that. Fascinatingly, they're also the company that many Australian manufacturers say they would prefer to deal with. Because when you do a deal with Aldi, they do a hard deal, but the contract you sign is what happens.
This gets us to one of the lesser known truths about supermarkets. You're not the only one paying them. The suppliers are paying too.
In order to get a product on a supermarket shelf, they are charged a variety of fees, if you would. So a slotting fee, and where the term comes from, was to create a slot in the warehouse. For example, if you have a frozen food product, it could cost you $10,000 to just get that slotting fee. Then on top of that, you have to give a promotional allowance to that retailer to help them promote. Usually that's in terms of sale prices. Then you have to support it with advertising. Sometimes, depending on the product, you have to support it with an in-store demonstration so people can taste it. And then you have your regular price on top, which a distributor has a markup, a broker has a markup to it. So there's a lot.
It is a lot, and it can be very problematic for suppliers.
It's a huge issue, and one of the things that the grocery code was attempting to fix, and it certainly made it better, but lots more needs to be done, is this situation. So you do a deal with Coles or Woolworths that they will pay you X amount for the product you are supplying, and then it's not quite true. Then if the stock turn isn't as good as you'd hoped it would be, there'll be an extra fee. There will be a fee if you want a better position on the shelf. There will be a fee, as you said, for in-store demonstration. There will be an extra fee for marketing because the product's not selling as well, or because the supermarket wants to promote your product. That's a good thing, isn't it? Except guess who gets to pay? So I think the reason lots of manufacturers have said, hey, the good thing about Aldi is you shake on it and that's it. There are no changes. There are no extra fees. There are no changes to contract. They pay you what they say they're going to pay you when they say they're going to pay. So they're also quite good payers. They pay, you know, in a fairly short time frame, which is not necessarily what we could say about some of the bigger players.
The bigger players are paying 120 days in arrears. So you don't get paid until 4 months after you invoice for supply.
It's simply unacceptable. They've got to pay their staff every week or fortnight. They've got to pay the farmers, the label manufacturers, the container manufacturers. None of them can wait that long.
But why do they do it, Kate? I mean, because Coles and Woolies, what they do not have is a cash flow problem. They can pay instantly.
They can. And remember, we pay them instantly. You know, we go into the supermarket and we buy the Mars bar and we give Coles or Woolworths the money immediately. So why the gap? Why the gap? Because they can. It's really that simple. They can use that money for international investments, for a whole range of other ways that they can make money. But they're using small business money to do it. In other words, those small suppliers that are getting paid in 4 months, sometimes if they're lucky, are funding those big guys and those big guys' capacity for international investment, often not in the same industry. It could be in property. It could be just on the money markets and so on. And quite seriously, that isn't all right. It's slowing down growth in Australia and it's slowing down job production in small business.
There must be a way of regulating to address what seems to be a very unfair situation. But Kate Carnell says Australia has been slow off the mark.
The EU legislated a few years ago to require 30-day payments under most circumstances. The UK is moving down that path, requiring big businesses to actually be transparent about their payment times. Various states in the US have done the same. So it really shows that these big companies, if they can get away with it, will use small businesses as their banks. We have to put a line in the sand. Now, the Business Council of Australia have put in place a voluntary code. My office has said, well, look, let's give this 12 months. If it works, we'll be applauding with the rest of them. Our experience globally is it hasn't worked very well. Voluntary codes work well for people who want to do the right thing, don't work so well for companies that are quite comfortable to go to 4 months plus payment times. But if the voluntary code doesn't work, I think Australia is going to have to move to a regulatory framework.
The country with the best practice, she says, is one of the world's most successful economies.
Germany has gone to legislation that says that all payments should be in 30 days unless both parties agree for whatever reason for a longer period of time, and that is done on a level playing field. But if there is a longer period of time and there ends up being a dispute that a small business believes they've been screwed a bit, then a longer period of time will be deemed to be an unfair contract clause. So even in a country like Germany that exports heavily, manufactures heavily, they've realised they have to put a line in the sand. And I'm not sure that Australia won't have to do the same.
This is The Money on RN, the ABC radio app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Ady. Today we're looking at supermarkets. And one thing you really have to know is that they're looking at you. Cathy O'Neill is a mathematician, data scientist, and the author of Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. She says the supermarkets are busy.
Collecting all the data they can from their customers, including, of course, their shopping history. They're getting them to sign on to loyalty cards with some benefits in order to collect that data more consistently. And they're using the data, and by the way, they're, at least in the States, also capable and often are actually buying extra data, profile data, from large data warehousing companies like Axiom to add to their profile of each of their customers, to give them a marketing silo, basically. That's an indication from their marketing silos, like how much income they have, what kind of goods they're interested in, whether they're interested in organic food, or, for example, whether they're sort of vulnerable to coupons or special deals, whether that would bring them into the store, whether they would buy more stuff with such offers. So they basically, on an individual basis, decide who they want to be as companies. Big data gives them the capacity, the capability of sort of being a different store for each person.
Doing all that enables them to target you as an individual. In America, that means coupons. Here, there's email offers and ads on social media. And although they want you in their loyalty program, supermarkets don't need you to join to know what you're up to.
They have video cameras in their stores, which almost all stores do at this point. Depending on what kind of software they're running on those systems, they could actually recognize individuals that are in the system already. That's one possibility. Another one is that your cell phone is just in your pocket, and your cell phone has sort of IDs that are used for like Wi-Fi, basically. Wi-Fi can bounce a signal off of your phone and sort of recognize you. It's supposed to be a relatively anonymous system, but actually tends not to be.
The law doesn't allow different prices for the same item in the same store, but potentially the technology clearly does.
Theoretically, what could happen is not only could the price vary depending on the person, but theoretically the price could vary even depending on the person's mood, right? These facial recognition programs don't only just recognize you, and sometimes they don't recognize you if they don't have a huge database with names attached, but they still might be able to glean your mood. They could say, oh, this person's depressed or this person's happy. They could figure out whether you're willing to pay more, theoretically, just by looking at your face, and they could theoretically adjust the price after you've already come to the counter.
Wow. So you can imagine a scenario in which the smart cameras and big data recognizes that, you know, perhaps you're in your mid-20s, you've just been through a breakup, you're buying chocolate. We can charge whatever we like for that.
That's a really good example, because they also will be able to pick up stuff off of your social media profile. So they might know that you've just been dumped, for example.
And online shopping doesn't have the same restrictions.
As much as there are laws now in sort of concrete, like real stores, those laws are pretty much non-existent as far as I know online. So, you know, we can say we have a history of sort of price fixing laws, but as soon as you go to Amazon or another place where you buy stuff online, it goes out the window. And in part, it goes out the window because, again, like you're going to get deals, you're going to get offers depending on who you are. So you could never really think of a price as the final price, even if it's the listed price.
Which has real implications because the world's most successful retailer is going after the supermarkets. Phil Limpert.
Amazon Fresh has been doing okay. Now with the acquisition of Whole Foods, they're going to do great. And there's a couple reasons for that. 90% of all Amazon Prime users, members, if you would, live within 10 miles of a Whole Foods. It's a very similar customer base. So today in the U.S., Amazon has about 100 distribution centers. Now with Whole Foods, think of every Whole Foods store as a distribution center. So they've now added 461 more distribution centers. And those trucks, again, to meet that model of that Amazon Prime customer, are within 10 miles. What Amazon Fresh has been lacking is great produce and great meats. With Whole Foods, they get that. They get meal kits. They get everything that somebody would want. So I believe, and I would predict, that Amazon Fresh will be the number one delivery vehicle for groceries in the U.S.
Not only that, Amazon is experimenting with making shopping in a physical store just as easy as it makes it online.
Amazon is testing that in beta right now. You just take your mobile device. As you walk in, you place it on a little kiosk so it knows who you are. And as you take everything off the shelves, you don't have a cashier to go to. You just put in a sack and walk out the door. And Walmart has just released their version of the same thing, which is actually even better than the Amazon Go concept and covers many more items. So I think, you know, the sense of reality is going to be altogether different when we go into a store. What we'll probably have is we'll have, you know, a grocerant in every store. We'll walk in. We might have lunch or dinner. We'll have a glass of wine as we shop the store, a smaller store, a much more fresh store, if you would. And then on the way out, we stop at a locker. And again, Amazon, who has lockers spread out through the U.S., now has another 461 locations to put Amazon lockers, so I can buy any one of those 5 billion gazillion products that Amazon has, and after I do my fresh foods shopping, I can just go into the locker and take out what I ordered online.
But for now, few Americans do their grocery shopping online, and it isn't clear that we will. Michelle Levine.
The key things that we're seeing from a research perspective is that every year we ask people whether they'd consider doing some of their shopping online, and every year about 26% of people say, yes, I would, and every year about 3% do. So there's an apparent desire and openness to do grocery shopping online, but whatever has been offered before, and we know that all of the big supermarkets have actually tried an online offering, it has not managed to get people to really do it. So Amazon needs to understand what it was that prevented people taking up this online shopping, even when it was offered to them. And if Amazon can overcome that problem, then they'll do extremely well. But I still see some issues with consumers in terms of their concerns about grocery shopping online.
Issues like the best before date, issues like wanting the fruit and vegetables to be perfect, the meat, fish and dairy to be chilled, and knowing exactly when it's going to be delivered.
And we want easy because we're lazy. You know, what we say we will do is really what we do. And the supermarkets know that devastatingly well. If I can have my baker, chemist, sushi bar and grocery shopping experience in one store without having to drag my children to four different locations, you know, which one's going to win with the best will in the world? Again, you have to, you know, it's almost like the online shopping experience. You have to try harder if you want to do that. So everything they can do to kind of grease the way and make it easier. Despite all our protestations, we're going to choose the easiest option.
That's why I'm easy. I'm easy like some...
So what does the future of the supermarket look like? Well, data scientist Cathy O'Neill does her grocery shopping online.
I think the future of the supermarket is Amazon. I think there will always be a place you could buy cigarettes and whiskey. In a spontaneous sense, you'll never, ever be able to get something immediately through a delivery service. But that could be done, honestly, with a vending machine. So, yeah, I don't hold out a lot of hope for the future of supermarkets.
But Phil Lempert isn't buying that.
Right now, online grocery shopping is less than 4%, so it's tiny. I don't think that's the future. I think what the future is, and a lot of people have talked about this for a while, is our kitchen becomes automated. So what you find in your cupboard are scales and scanners. You find that in your refrigerator. You find it in your freezer. So what you do is you go online for certain products. And for example, I never want to run out of milk. So I'll say that, you know, when I'm running low on milk, make sure that I have it a day before I run out. So that scale and the scanner that's in my refrigerator knows when I'm taking the milk in and out and how much it weighs. So there's certain products that we're going to be having automatically replenished. You know, the bottled waters, the toilet paper that nobody ever wants to run out of, paper towels, milk. And the retail experience will then, with a grocer on it, will just get rid of so many of those products. And those will automatically be replenished for us, and we're going to have more fun talking to the butcher and the fishmonger, and it's all going to be about fresh foods.
And although she's in Australia, Michelle Levine is in the same ballpark.
One of the things I've learned is whenever I make predictions, they just generally don't work out. So I'm quite conservative. I can't imagine a world without shops. Our research has actually interestingly shown, as of last year, there was a turnaround and people are now going back to shopping. They're actually making more retail visits. So that resonates with my view of the world. You know, we were tracking fewer and fewer shopping visits as people went online. It's now swung back. I think that we will have people shopping. I think we will have people visiting supermarkets and retail outlets of various kinds. But I think the experience will be better because basically the option will be do it online if it's not fun or a useful, exciting experience. But for those people, and it's generally people who can afford to pay a little bit more, who are looking for an experience, there'll be smart retailers and providers of all sorts of products and services creating a really optimum experience.
Thanks to Michelle Levine, Chief Executive of Roy Morgan Research, Phil Lempert of supermarketguru.com, Cathy O'Neill, author of Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy, lifestyle editor at Choice, Kate Brown, and the Australian Small Business and Family Enterprise Ombudsman, Kate Carnell. The Money is produced by Kate Piercy. Our sound engineer is Russell Stapleton. I'm Richard Adie.